Ladies and gentlemen, here she is now. Let's get together and meet that very delightful, that sultry siren of the Southland, her lovely Betty Page.
The official Betty Page podcast is a platform to discuss the captivating life of the legendary icon. We'll also explore her profound impact on pinup culture, fashion, body positivity, mental health, and more.
Hello, hello, Betty Babes and Bows. Welcome to the official Betty Page podcast. This is episode 10, and you're here with your host, Tori Rodriguez, and Mark Morey, and producer Ben.
Hey, Tori, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, I'm great. How are you?
Well, I'm really excited about this podcast because we're going to be interviewing a filmmaker who's very familiar with Betty Page.
Yeah, definitely a big piece of the Betty puzzle. So we're interviewing Kelvin Mao, and he's the filmmaker of Dave Stevens' Drawn to Perfection documentary that came out last year. And yeah, and has a good chunk of Betty in it. So we're excited to interview him tonight.
And as a huge fan of The Rocketeer, I was equally excited for this. Just, I love talking about Betty Page, but I love talking about Rocketeer. So this was kind of a dream thing to sit in for me. So I really, really had fun with this one. And I think all the Betty fans, if they should know who Dave Stevens is, and they should have seen this documentary by now. But if they haven't, I think after they hear this, they're going to definitely stream it.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, Betty considered Dave her best friend in her later years. So very pivotal person in Betty's life.
For sure. You guys want to do, before we get into this, you want to do some news? I've got a few news topics.
Oh, give us the news, Ben.
Yeah.
Well, first off, do either of you know who Rondo Hatton was by any chance?
No, I haven't heard the name.
He's not very well known, but he was a character actor, I believe, back maybe in the 30s, 40s. He was in a bunch of old black and white movies. He was a big brute. he always played like the strong man. There's a lot of fandom surrounding him, especially in the horror movie community. So there's an award. There's an award program every year called the Rondo Hatton Awards. It celebrates everything in science fiction fandom, horror fandom, just all of it thrown together. It has the best movie of the year, the best magazine of the year, the best this, the best that. Well, one of the categories is the best fan event of the year. And Betty Page Day 2023 is nominated for best fan event.
No way. Wow.
And hey, Ben, there you go.
That's incredible.
It was exciting. Somebody texted me the other day and they said, did you know that Betty Page Day is nominated for a Rondo Award? That's what they're called, the Rondo Awards.
That's great.
Oh my God, you had to have been so excited.
Ben's going to get a Rondo.
And the trophies are so cool. They're a little Rondo Hatton head. If you've seen The Rocketeer, the brute in the movie, like the henchman, is modeled 100% off of Rondo Hatton, like the big nose, the big ears.
Now I know who you're talking about. There's pictures of him in the documentary we're going to be talking about, right?
Mm-hmm. That's okay. So I think it could all tie together. You know, we interviewed Kelvin Mao that directed the Dave Stevens documentary. Dave Stevens drew a character based off of Rondo Hatton. Now,
yes.
Betty Page Day is nominated for, it's all too much, right? So if you go to rondoaward.com, you can vote for it there. And there's a lot of other cool categories too. If you're a monster kid at heart, if you like, you know, old monster movies, you'll probably appreciate a lot of the categories. Monster kids love Betty. I've learned that. People that love old movies and like science fiction and horror movies, it seems like Betty Page kind of falls into that. And that probably has a lot to do with Dave Stevens, honestly, with him introducing her into the comic book world and fandom and stuff like that.
So, yeah.
Everybody vote for Betty Page Day.
For sure. Yeah, we'll have to post about that too individually.
Post about that on social media too, and I'll repost it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I will.
Yep. Definitely. And I want to show off really quick the new issue of Beautiful Bizarre Magazine. And you'll see the cover here is a beautiful painting by Olivia.
Gorgeous.
With Betty with a black cat. I mean, you can't really beat Betty with a black cat.
You really can't.
But this magazine just came out. I got it in the mail. You can order it from Beautiful Bizarre Magazine. And I'll say it's definitely worth it because this is like a conversation. You can put this on the coffee table. When people come over, they're going to look at it. It's really, really cool.
Nice.
So definitely check that out. But other than that, I think that's about all I've got on my notes. And I think I'm super excited to get into this interview with Kelvin Mao.
Absolutely.
Yes, stay tuned for our interview with Kelvin Mao, director of Dave Stevens' Drawn to Perfection. Hello, Betty fans. Welcome to another official episode of the Betty Page podcast. And we have a very special guest today, Kelvin Mao, who's the director of the documentary film Dave Stevens, Drawn to Perfection. Welcome, Kelvin. We're so excited to talk to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, Mark and Ben and Tori.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I really enjoyed watching the documentary. And of course, there's some filmmaker questions I want to ask you. But one of the key things, I mean, this is a Betty Page fan audience. Talk to me about Betty Page being Dave Stevens' muse.
Well, it's interesting. We never quite got, like, because we didn't have Dave with us to ask, we never got quite the origin story. But as far as I can tell, you know, he'd seen pictures of her when he was a teenager. And it's just sort of stayed with him all his life. In the 70s, I know he would go to like bookshops and magazine stands and places like in Hollywood and, you know, to hunt down like old magazines and photos and stuff. So he was drawing her very early on in his career before he was a professional and sort of, I think, brought her to a lot of other people's attention. Bill Stout, who he shared a studio with, and Richard Hescox both mentioned that they both learned about her from him and his collection and sort of got sucked in that fashion.
And then, but he introduced her to the public in the Rocketeer comic book. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. But he was pretty taken with her before that. Brink Stevens told a story where when they were dating and he brought her to the Hanna-Barbera studios, one of the other artists commented, "Oh, Dave, you found your Betty." So it was already sort of known back then among his friends and his artist friends, colleagues and whatnot, that that he very much liked her aesthetic. And yes, he started drawing her for publication for The Rocketeer in April of 1982.
Okay, so that was the first publication of The Rocketeer comic book, 1982. So that would have been really, I'm guessing, the first time Betty Page would have been seen outside of kind of the pinup photo context. Is that right?
I think so. Although I know Olivia had been drawing her for very early on. And then also, right. Who's the fetish painter?
Eric Stanton.
Eric Stanton. And then I know I'm thinking of somebody, Robert Blue. So I'm not sure when he started. I'm not a Betty Page expert. So a lot of the stuff I came across, I know that actually Dave took lessons from Robert Blue before he passed away, painting lessons when he went back and tried to learn how to paint. But there were other artists interested in her before Dave. I think just the Rocketeer being a popular comic book sort of introduced her to an audience that hadn't been aware before.
Right. I think Robert Blue might actually have preceded Dave Stevens, and he had those paintings of Betty, but I don't think those were widely known. I mean, I'm thinking in The Rocketeer, this was what started the process of introducing Betty to a new, younger, wider audience.
Certainly. The 82 was in the middle of like an early independent comic book boom. This is where like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles came from. And other popular comics are still running today, Cerebus, and other things like that. So and comic books were hot then. So if you just look at the sort of print run numbers, you know, you would see that like, you know, it's reaching a lot of people and in a sort of pop culture, you know, fashion.
Okay, well, good. So tell us how you got started on this thing. I mean, what made you decide to do this documentary?
Well, it's interesting. It was really the pandemic. It's a child of the pandemic, which I think a lot of people had these sort of projects where, you know, we were sitting around not really knowing exactly what to do. And a friend of mine, Rob Chatlin, who's a other producer and the editor of the movie, of Drawn to Perfection, he had just finished editing a documentary on Scotch whiskey that was supposed to premiere in Scotland in April of 2020. obviously everyone remembers what happened in March of 2020. So that movie got put on the shelf and he was sort of sitting around trying to figure out what to do. He had a career in promo editing at FX Network. So he'd been doing promos every week for Sons of Anarchy and shows like that. And just really enjoyed doing an entire feature editing. So it was his suggestion actually, why don't we all do something between myself and him and Robert Windham, who's our executive producer. The three of us are drinking buddies, for lack of a better word. We're all very enthusiastic about comic books, fine whiskey, and poker. There's a lot of strange stuff and cigars.
Nice trifecta.
Yes. So basically, we had a little pod going. So we're in Rob Chatelain's backyard sitting at three corners because you're supposed to isolate. Everybody's got a little table with their own bottle and their own ashtray. And we're just yelling back and forth, in the yard to each other. And Rob Chatelain says, "Hey, I like making this documentary. Would you like to do another one?" And we said, "Well, sure. What would it be about?" And he said, "What about Dave Stevens?" And Dave Stevens is how Robert Windham and I have met. We both collect original comic book art. Robert's a little bit newer to it than I am. And when he started, he made a list of the things he really wanted to own. And one of them was a Dave Stevens art. So someone steered him to me because I had been helping Dave's family manage his estate. So we just struck up an online friendship that way. And then we met up at San Diego Comic-Con probably – it's been 2018 or 2017. Anyway, we hit it right off. He lives 7 minutes away, So everything just sort of lines up. So that's basically what happened. And obviously, Robert knew about Dave because he was a fan. I knew Dave as a friend and helped his family and stuff, along with my friend Dave Mandel. Also, we sort of were a team helping to sort of, because Dave's family wasn't really very involved in his life in terms of entertainment and stuff. So they didn't really know what to do with all the stuff or what was important, what wasn't. So we did our best to sort of steer them in the right direction. So then the ball got rolling. I think this must have been late summer or fall of 2020. And then we were like, yeah, let's do this. So we just started prepping. And then there was Bleeding Cool did a nice release for us. But then we couldn't do anything. You couldn't interview anybody or shoot anything. So we did a lot of online research, and I was me just emailing people asking if they would be in it, whether they had any photos or artwork or scans or anything like that, magazine interviews. And we were going to interview Jim Silk, who's a very close friend of Dave Stevens, also associated with Betty Page, of course. Jim Silk did a lot of Betty Page art. And Jim is a good friend of mine that we became friends through Dave Stevens. And Jim agreed to be our guinea pig, and he was going to film our first interview, on the lowdown in December of 2020. But then he got terribly ill, not from COVID. He just was hospitalized for months. So we basically couldn't start until April. So April 2021 is when we started filming interviews, and we just did it on weekends. I'm sure Mark, it's just when you have time to do it. And when other people who you want to do it have time to be there. And we'd shoot a couple of weekend here and there, and probably went from April to into the fall. We get all the local people first. And then in the fall, we made two trips, an East Coast trip to see Mike Kaluta and Adam Hughes and Laura Martin and also Chris Danio and Ricky Licote. We were supposed to see Steranko, but unfortunately we weren't able to make that work. And then the West Coast, we went up to see Bob Schreck in Portland, and Hess Cox was in Reno, and then the family had moved to Idaho. So we went there to film the archives, shoot artwork, and also interview Jennifer, Dave's younger sister. So that's sort of the process.
Sounds like you were sort of paying for it out of your own pocket.
Oh, yes. No, it was 100% self-finance. So we didn't make a dime. So let me be clear about that. We made negative dimes, in fact. It was really something to do creatively. But it was really fulfilling and enjoyable. Robert, none of us are entertainment except for Rob Chatelain, who was the editor. I had written a screenplay that had been produced. It came out in 2019, a Bruce Willis movie called 10 Minutes Gone. And Robert Wyndham had written and produced a rom-com that was like kind of like a Hallmark Channel level thing. But he got it shot like right under the pandemic wire. So he had a movie ready to like release in January of 2021. So like it was like the top like romantic comedy on iTunes for like months because there was nothing else.
Wow.
So he ended up doing a sequel. He ended up doing a sequel of that because it was so, you know, well timed. And I remember him saying like they had pickups, like a weekend of pickups, and they're like running around town when you're not supposed to be doing anything in that like last weekend. Or the weekend probably it was, I think the shutdown was like a Wednesday or something, and he was like running around on Saturday. Something like that. Anyway, hopefully I don't get him in trouble.
So did you guys do a Kickstarter?
We didn't. We did a Kickstarter after. They don't really put out documentaries on physical media anymore. You know, if it comes out on Netflix, like, you know, something like Three Identical Strangers comes out, like everyone watches it on Netflix. Nobody goes to Best Buy or Target and buys a Blu-ray of it or a DVD. So we did a Kickstarter in order so we could have a physical release. It didn't make any sense that you had this great artist that it was about, Dave Stevens, who was a tremendous artist, and you know, you could hold his artwork in your hand and then there would be nothing physical for people who liked his work and collected his work to have. So we did it for that. We also put out a comic book that we lucked out in the middle of interviewing, conducting interviews. We found out from Danny Bilson, who's a writing partner, Paul DeMeo and him, they wrote the Rocketeer movie. And we found out that they had written a short comic book story before Paul passed away in 2018 that never been published. So, you know, we went from that interview with Danny to an interview with Adam Hughes, who was kind of like one of Dave's main successors in the comic book field, and said, and also Dave was a mentor to Adam. And we asked Adam, would you want to draw this story for us? And he was like, he jumped at it. And then we were sort of off to the races. I had also written a story for IDW back in 2012 for a sort of a Rocketeer tribute series that had gone 8 issues and it was supposed to be 12, but they ran out of steam because there were too many artists who were late, I think, for poor Scott Dunbier to be able to put out the last 4. But I had written the story. It had been approved. It was sitting there. So we sort of cobbled all these things together and did this comic book for the, you know, so there would be more items for the Kickstarter. So that's what it was for. And the other thing was we didn't really want to have to take any input or add anybody any credits to this. So we wanted to sort of do it the way we did it. And then, you know, it would turn out how it turned out. There was opportunities to actually sell it and make money to one of the big streamers, but it was made clear to us, by them, that they would want to make changes, and we didn't agree with the changes. So that was the end of that.
Yeah, they always want to make those changes, the suits, right?
Yes,
the non-creatives,
yes.
Right?
No, it would have been a perfect fit. I mean, you can probably guess who it was. They have the Rocketeer movie streaming on their platform, but I won't say the name.
Well, I have one more question I want to ask you, and then I'll sit back and let
sure.
Tori and Ben. I wanted to ask you something about the Rocketeer, because the story I heard was that the reason Betty Page was not in that movie by name was because at that time, Betty Page, nobody knew where she was, and they needed her permission or her rights in order to use her name. And since they couldn't find her, didn't know where she was, that's why she's not mentioned in the movie. Is that right?
That's correct. It ends up being the Jenny character. This was a, you know, creative decision by Disney. And I think it's a valid one. You don't know. And you don't know. And it wouldn't be fair to just take somebody's image and likeness and just co-opt it like that. Dave Stevens felt it was very important to him. He really wanted her in it because he wanted it to be, you know, right. He wanted people to know about her. So it was more about like a bigger platform to get for people to know who Betty Page was. And I think that was one of the sort of like hard fought things. And I think between Dave's friends and his lawyers and stuff, they finally got him to run. And I think she did a fine job in the movie. Jennifer Connelly, I thought was great.
I love her.
Changed it a little bit, but you know, it's a Disney movie and I don't think it violated the spirit, you know, of the character. But yes, that's correct. And he really, really, he really wanted that. David really wanted that. It just, you know, and he was, I mean, they were right. Right. I mean, the movie comes out in 91 and she comes back 2 years later, you know, So it would have been a real surprise. If, you know. Yeah. So,
Kelvin, I have a question for Kelvin, and Mark, you can chime on this too. Making a documentary seems to me like it would be really stressful with the responsibility, especially somebody with fandom around them, like a lot of like big fans. Kelvin, was there any stress making this documentary with the responsibility of, you know, doing a documentary about somebody you were friends with and has a huge fan base, has a lot of fandom around them, or was it just a good time? I mean, was there any hard parts about it?
You're right. It was stressful. I didn't care about the fans or anything. I mean, I'd help publish like a lot of Dave's work after he passed away. I get the Rocketeer. I helped with Dave Mandel get the Rocketeer back into print over at IDW with Scott Dunbier. I mean, I had done my best. You know what I mean? I had spent like years trying to, you know, from when Dave passed away in 2008 until about 2013, you know, we were working on publishing projects. And so I sort of felt like, you know, look, I've done my part. Like I don't think you can impeach my motives, but the real pressure was just like, you know, his family had to like it. You know what I mean? I didn't want to make something that I thought was good. And his sister and his, you know, his, you know, niece and nephew and, you know, they, you know, his mother had passed away at this point, but like, that was really the pressure that they would like this thing. And on my own personal, you know, like, would Dave like this thing? Actually, I knew the answer from that beginning. He would hate it. So that it's very easy to sort of get that out of my head in terms of pressure. But like, the family and stuff, that really was a big deal to me. And I actually said, if we do another documentary, I said this to the other guys, like, please let it not be something like this. I'd like it to be something I just love, and that's it. You know what I mean? So, what about you, Mark? How was it for you?
Well, you know, what you made me think about was in making it, I spent many years from when I first met Betty Page and started interviewing her and till the film was finished. Actually, I met her in 1996 and recorded a couple of audio interviews with her in the 90s and didn't actually get the film out until 2012. So, and I wasn't working on it that whole time, but, you know, other things got in the way and, you know, raising money and all that kind of thing. Now, what was your question? I forgot.
The pressure of
well, yet what you made me think about was the reason I was talking about such a long time. The more I got to know Betty by reading about her, by looking at her photographs, by interviewing people, the more I fell in love with her. And you, if you're going to make a documentary like this, especially if it's out of your own pocket, you have to really feel strongly about what you're doing. It's not just a job you're doing, right? So it sounds like that was a similar experience to you.
Yeah, I don't know that most people. I'm lucky that it was good friends, because the amount of time I spent with the editor, just like, oh God, I'm sure he still has nightmares. We would spend like 3 hours on like 30 seconds right. of like a footage, and then I like just trying to get it perfect, and then I'd be like, nope, it was better the way it was before. Hit the undo. Avid's got to undo, right? So it would be like undo, and then he would just load up, and he would groan. But he would say that that's how editing is done. You have to like
exactly. I mean, that's,
try it out. You know,
in my experience, that's what your experience is true on all documentaries that I've been involved in. I can tell you that. So,
yeah. Well, I've only done the one so far. So you know, it was fun. It was a lot of fun. Because you get to see the process. You do a small film like this, you get to see everything from the beginning to the end. And so you know it, you know what I mean? Like, the only difference between this and a feature is what's actually filmed. Obviously, there's VFX and things like that. But, you know, we had to do a sound mix and get a composer and, like, sit in for that stuff and give a guy notes and know whether we liked it or not. That was the other thing. We didn't know exactly what things like the music should sound like. In fact, we edited for so long without any music that like everybody thought it sounded weird without music, but we knew it had to be there. We couldn't just have this thing with nothing in the background. So that was weird. And then the other thing was just a lot of the Dave Stevens audio in the movie was from an interview that I conducted with him about a year before he passed away, maybe a little less. That I had done. It was actually not meant to be an interview. It was just, he was working on his art book, Brush of Passion, and he was just looking to like generate ideas. So we just sat down and I asked him questions, and we just talked for like 6 hours, you know, I mean, with a dinner in there. And then, and I had it transcribed and I just had put it away. So, but we were lucky we had that because we were able to use it to have his voice, his presence in there, because despite him being a good looking guy, you'd think he would run into a video camera every once in a while at a show, but this is just all before. And you, I'm sure you had this problem too. Well, Betty was obviously reclusive, but like, you know, before, right now in the age of smartphones, you can find any popular artist, anybody who's, you know, makes appearances and stuff, and you can get a wealth of footage of them. But if you go back before, you know, 2010 or so, like, it's just hard to do. And then your old digital media, like even still photos, they won't hold up. You're trying to get this stuff up to 4K, and you know, those are the kind of weird problems you run into you don't think about.
Now, you had gotten in touch with me while you were making the film, and you were asking about some footage I had of Dave Stevens in Betty Page Reveals All. So tell me about that.
Oh, right. There was a Entertainment Tonight, or was it? No, it was a True Hollywood Stories, something like that. Yeah. And it's so funny. You can get on YouTube and find every episode of this show, every episode. But the one, of course, because of CMG or whatever, the one that's not on there, that's been yanked off there, is the one that I needed. And so it was very, very difficult to find that footage. So I don't even remember how we did it. I do know that there were assets we found after we finished the film that we were like, you know, yeah, exactly. It's locked. It's in, BitMax has it. We can't do anything. You know, we got a better copy of something. And right. It's just like, but we had a good guy who did our upconverting. I mean, you have to do a lot of that if you have archival stuff now, because everybody expects it to be at least high definition. Our movie is actually in 4K, although I would hate to watch it in 4K, just because if you have like photographs or something scanned and you're watching it in 4K, like every little mote of dust like stands out at you, just it jumps out, and it takes forever. You know, cleaning that stuff up. We have a designer who he's the creative director on a Matt Groening show, but we have this poor guy like doing Photoshop grunt work on our just because he's a buddy of ours. So he's like, "Oh, I'll pitch in." It's like, you know, it's like, oh, you know, after the you know 300th photo or whatever that he's fixed, I think he got a little tired of that. But he did our movie poster. He was good. It was kind of like a very much a let's all get the guys together and do a show or whatever. Yeah, everybody within our circle of whiskey drinking friends sort of tried to help out when they could. You know, if sometimes it was just, you know, a guy had a house that we could use for a location for an interview. You know, my wife's friend, you know, worked for a comic book company, worked for Bongo Comics, and designed a font that was based off of Dave's handwriting. You know what I mean? Because she was a letterer, and that's what she did. You know, so we got a lot of. We're lucky that a lot of people just pitched in and helped in whatever way they could. So, and also cool. You, Mark.
Oh, well, it was a community effort. These independent documentaries are always a community effort.
Absolutely.
And I find it really striking that y'all conceived of this while you're sitting around drinking whiskey and you actually like followed through.
And I think that is
y'all
kind
did
of,
that.
That's kind of crazy. Everybody,
because in my experience, yes, I usually don't follow through with the ideas I come up with while I'm drinking. But I don't know about Mark and Ben.
No, it's true. I'm not really sure how to explain that either, because I often come up with I have a lot of other ideas that were come up with, you know, that were created in those circumstances that did not come to fruition. But part of it was probably having three people. We were all enthusiastic. We were all in a position. Like, we're all older, so it's like, nobody was needing to pay their rent off this. It was just, look, we all have like boring, like autopilot jobs. Let's try and do something fun. Well, that's what we'll help us spend our weekends for a while. We'll drive our wives crazy. You know, fortunately the one guy's not married. So he's sort of the nexus. That's where we had our production meetings. That's where the editing suite is. That's where, you know, his house was used many times because a number of people didn't want to be interviewed inside because of COVID, and oh God, nothing worse than interviewing someone outside. I'm sure Mark is aware of this because of sound. Like in LA, there's a helicopter flying over every 5 seconds, you know, or birds, right. Or like there was one time where like Bruce Timm is in the backyard and it's like like a jet goes over and then a helicopter and then like a crow starts like yapping on top of a tree. And then I swear it was like an owl. There was like something else that came in. We were like, okay, we're just going to like now this is different because our sound guy has pointed out that like there's like AI tools that are very good at stripping this sort of background. Right. So you can kind of do that now. But like, oh man, one time we were on top of a hill in Sherman Oaks, like a cul-de-sac. So there's nothing around and Brink Stevens comes in. And as soon as she sits down in a chair, a gardener on a Sunday like starts up his weed whack. And then after she's done, there's just helicopters going all over for this for Rebecca Smith, Holland. I feel bad for her because it's just constant. And it turned out there was a fire because there's wildfires in Los Angeles. But his house was like right in the flight path. So every helicopter that took off was going to circle around this house and then go to wherever it was supposed to go. So yeah, those were not the fun things. I mean, what else? We rented a place and it was like in the alley next to like a Home Depot or something. So they were cutting wood in the back, you know.
Oh my God. You
name it. But we had funny stories too. Like Danny Bilson came and was so thrilled about the makeup. And when he was done with his interview, like the makeup artist asked if he wanted her to take off the makeup. He said, no, I'm going to like my wife's birthday dinner. Or was their anniversary? So he went straight in full makeup to the dinner.
Oh my God. I wonder how that went over.
I think just because he would look the best. He was just like, I think he had a suit in the car or whatever to change into. It was very funny. I thought that was
a great laugh. So that was great timing for him too.
Fringe benefits.
Yeah. Yes.
So Kelvin, I'm going to ask you to look at Ben's screen and look over his shoulder on the left side of the screen and see if you see something.
I see a helmet there. I see a helmet on the desk. Is that a prop or is that like a master replicas?
This is the real deal.
All right.
I say a real deal. This is a very screen accurate, if I should say myself, Rocketeer helmet. I have the entire costume actually. And it's kind of funny because you were talking about the genesis of the documentary came from COVID. Well, when the lockdown happened, my wife works in healthcare. She was really stressed out. I'm self-employed. I was really stressed out. And I thought, you know what? If we're going down like this, I'm going to become the Rocketeer. So I spent all summer on into the fall gathering all of the parts of the costume. It took about 6 months. I had to get the helmet from a guy from Canada. I got the jacket from some coat maker in England. The boots were from Australia. And I spent way too much money on it, but
I know this feeling,
but that one day when I got it all in and I put it on and went out in the yard and took some pictures, actually, I'll tell you what, let me see if I can pull up a picture. It was like the best. And you know,
is it action? Are you running? This, I want to see
this costume is so hot. Let me see. You can see a picture right there. It's so
hot. Yeah, that's awesome.
Got the Mauser and everything. Very, very cool.
I got it all. Amazing. Yeah, the jetpack lights up, the fan spins, everything.
That's incredible.
But like, it's so hot that like, I want to wear it at the conventions, but unless it's below 60 degrees outside, it's not happening.
Maybe you could wear it to like Emerald City just happened in Seattle and it's cold there. So maybe you just reserve your appearances for like cold weather shows. I'm sure it was cold enough there. Or maybe you could reroute the fans from the pack into the outfit. You know what I mean? To like suck out the heat or through the vents in the helmet. What do you think?
I think you're onto something. I need something. I wore it one day when it was about 75 degrees to a community event, and I lasted about 5 minutes.
Oh God!
Well, the other thing that's cool is like if you're in the cold, you'd be like in the football games in the sideline. When you take the helmet off, your hair will like steam up and everything, and you might be able to get a cool effect out of this. I don't know. I think there might be fringe benefits to like doing it in the cold myself in terms of just visual effect, you know. But that's pretty awesome.
That's it.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. That is really cool, man.
A nice connection. So you're telling me that you did all this so that you could eventually host a podcast and spring this on.
That was part of the plan. You know, I made like a little like 5-step plan, and the fifth step was interviewing Kelvin Mao and showing him the picture of what I did during lockdown. So something good came out of it.
I respect your long game, Ben. I respect your long game.
Well, and Kelvin, I don't know if you know, but Ben is responsible for erecting a monument to Betty Page in front of Hume Falk High School for on her 100th, what it would have been her 100th birthday. And we were all there last year. Yeah. Wow. Tell them a little bit about it, Ben.
That's how I met Mark and Tori. And it was just for Betty's 100th birthday, and the city decided to recognize her. And I will say that I made a special point at one part in the ceremony to thank Dave Stevens for everything he did for Betty. It almost slipped my mind, and I had to like jump up real quick and say, I've got something I need to get off my chest. This is, you know, for Dave Stevens as well. And a lot of people came up to me after that, and with tears in their eyes, saying like, thank you for saying that about Dave. It was really, really cool. And I meant it, because as a Betty fan, I would be lying if I didn't say that part of the Rocketeer in the comics and stuff is what got me into Betty Page fandom. So I'm definitely a product of that.
Well, I appreciate that. It's how I did it too. I didn't meet Dave until I moved to LA and went to my first Comic-Con in 1992. So, you know, for a decade before that, I worked in a comic book shop actually when the book came out. That's how I knew her as well. And I didn't become friends with Dave until 7 years after that. So we became friends in like 99-ish, you know, because, you know, obviously I had books signed by him at the show, but like, you know, he's Dave Stevens. So it's very kind of shy I had to find a guy to introduce me to him. I had to find a friend of a friend who knew him to basically say, hey, would you introduce me? And then, we just hung out and he was a nice guy. But, you know, this happens a lot, I'm sure, for everybody when you meet someone like that. What about you, Mark? I mean, what was it like meeting Betty Page for the
first time? Well, I'd take her to lunch in L.A. and she'd tell me all these stories of bondage and fetish photo shoots. It's like your grandmother, right, sitting there telling you about this stuff. It was kind of mind blowing. But she's very matter of fact about it, just like she sounds in my film. And in fact, I wanted to ask you to describe a little bit about after Betty surfaced, she and Dave became friends. Tell us about that.
Oh yes, he met her for the first time. Let me check my notes. I think it was March 31st of 94. Yes. And I think there was a lawyer that she was associated with that worked on the book. His name was
James Swanson.
Yes, exactly. He had big eyebrows. I remember that. I never met him, but I've seen the pictures. He reminded me of Zach Quinto. Okay. But he knew that Dave had been trying to meet her, and they were doing some kind of event, and just said, do you want to come and help, you know, like get her from place to place. So I guess he was just her driver for that day. And he wrote a whole, you know, sort of journal entry about like his date with Betty Page is what he called it. Became, close friends, very, very protective. And I think it's kind of interesting because it is sort of this thematic thing where he was very protective, but I've never met her. I mean, I knew that they were friends. He said that. I knew when he would go and, help her groceries and buy a Christmas tree. I've heard all these stories. It was never one of those things where we didn't have the kind of relationship where I would have felt like comfortable intruding. It was a very male relationship. We didn't talk about dating. We talked about art and like nerdy stuff. And like, the other stuff just sort of came out organically. It's hard to describe. I'll tell you a story. It was like the first time that I realized we were good friends. I mean, I really kind of hit home. Was one time he invited me out to lunch, and we used to go to lunch at this place called I've just lost it. There was a diner nearby. It was in Parks and Rec. It was like a diner they used there, and there was two of them. This is going to drive me crazy. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is, I show up to this lunch, and his parents are there. So I have lunch with Dave Stevens and his parents, his elderly parents, Bud and Carolyn, and I'm like, okay, sure, I'll go with it. They were in town, whatever. And then he gets up to go to the bathroom, and his mother says to me, I'm so glad, he has a friend like you. And I realize that he's introducing me to his parents because he's sick. And if somebody needs to tell them something that like it's going to be me, you know? And so then that was one of those things where, like, he never explained it to me. It just sort of, like, happened, and I realized, and then that was fine. Unfortunately, it went the other way. When Dave's father passed away, like, a year after this, like, his mother called me so that I could go over there and be there so he wouldn't be alone when she called him to tell him. So that was a very awful, sad thing that happened. But you know, you start to realize Dave was a real he was a fan of the sort of subtle gesture, and but you knew it, you know, when you were sort of on the receiving end. It was always very well thought out and insightful. Yeah, I'm not sure where I was going with that.
he was clearly an amazing friend, and like that's one of the things that was so striking. Like again, it was great to see in your film, you know, all the details of all the things he did for Betty. I mean, small and large. I mean, like just the fact that he was responsible, you know, largely responsible for this resurgence in her fame her fame in general. And then just knowing like all the special things he did for her toward the end of her life and in her older years, and in the book that I wrote with Betty's nephew, Ron Brim, which is called Betty Page, The Lost Years, in two of her letters, she talks about my best friend, Dave Stevens.
And I have that. I think we have that book. We used it for research. So we accumulated a small Betty Page library. I remember I was just trying to see the parallels of Dave taking care of Betty and then us taking care of Dave. I remember my wife used to joke that we were, if you guys seen the movie Ed Wood,
oh yeah,
like
Johnny, that's my favorite movie of all time.
My wife used to say that like we were like Ed Wood. Dave Mandela and I were Ed Wood to Dave's Bela Lugosi, and I always got mad about that because like he's not like a drug addict, you know. But I've since come to appreciate that was said in with good intentions and not in a mocking fashion. So
it's funny you say that, because I actually was thinking just the other day, I was thinking of Dave and Betty's relationship a lot like Ed Wood and Bela Lugosi's, you know, somebody who's reclusive, maybe just doesn't understand the impact they've had on pop culture. Just kind of in their own little world. And then that somebody comes in and they're just fascinated with them, and it's their idol, it's their muse, you know. It's very similar, actually. But yeah, that's my favorite movie of all time. When you brought it up, I lit up. I'm sure, like,
I'm a big fan of that movie too. So yeah, no. Mark, I have a question for you. Yeah. If one of these things that we never could answer, and a lot of people that were, you know, helping with involved with the documentary were also curious. I mean, I sort of had my own feelings. Like, is it possible that there exists a photo of Betty Page with Dave Stevens? And my theory was Dave would never have asked for this. You know, the only way this could exist is if Betty asked for this, and it might be with her effects. That's the only way I can imagine that there would be a picture taken with the two of them together in her older years, because he really respected that she didn't want to really, you know, want to be remembered the way she was and all those things. And so I'm curious what your opinion is.
Well, if there would be anyone that would have had Betty would have allowed to have her picture taken, I'm sure it would have been Dave. But I think it probably did not happen from what I know of Betty, because I spent years trying to convince her to go on camera to do an interview, and she just wouldn't do it. And that's why I ended up using these audio recordings I made as her voice for the narration. And the only pictures that exist, as far as I know, of Betty in her later years is that one night she visited the Playboy Mansion. And she had herself all fixed up. I think she even dyed her hair. And then there's a picture with her and Anna Nicole Smith, I think. And, you know, there's two or three pictures from that event. As far as I know, that's the only pictures of Betty in her later years.
The same for me, too. I mean, those are the only things we came across. It seemed like it was from the same evening. Olivia had some better ones. We didn't ask to borrow them just because, you know, it didn't seem like it was something that we wanted to pursue. Dave wouldn't have approved. And then, of course, I think there's one that like is on the internet and like very low res, grainy from the same event. So it's just something that people had wondered. Everybody asked me that, and that's my feeling as well. So
okay, well, I had a couple of things.
I think.
Go ahead, Tori.
Sorry, real quick. I was just going to say, I think there must have been two different events, which I'm curious about what they were, because or what one of the other one was. Because in one or two of those pictures that you're talking about, Mark, she had her hair dyed, like right. You said. And then I've seen other ones where it was gray.
Right. That's true. And she has when her hair is gray, she has a kind of flannel shirt on, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Yes. That's the one I'm thinking of that's sort of online. She'd been to the mansion a few times. I mean, Dave took her there and Hefner showed the Rocketeer for her, you know, there. And I imagine that wouldn't have been a dolled up thing. And he had, you know, I'm sure Playboy had its own photographers. So they actually might have something in their archives that just overlooked, you know what I mean? That's nobody's really thinking about. Yeah. I'm sure if you're there shooting pictures all the time, first of all, they probably can't let most of these pictures can't get out. But also, you know, like someone's got to go through them all. You're talking about a non-digital age here. And like, who's going to sift through like, you know, 80,000 negatives or whatever and trying to figure this out? I mean, someone might do it someday, but like.
If anyone's listening and has access and wants to get on that hunt, please do. We don't know what the reward will be, but.
Well, certainly at this point, I think that like it's far enough along where like, I feel like, you know, like nobody's going to get too angry about it. If something were like that were to come out. But also my understanding is that Playboy, they're sort of not the most organized people in terms of like their archives and stuff. So, but yeah, it would be great if somebody heard this and were like, wait a minute, I have a whole hard drive or I got a, you know, a file cabinet full of slides or something like that. That would be pretty cool.
Well, yeah, I wanted to tell you, I had an interaction with Billy Campbell while I was making Betty Page Reveals All. And as far as I remember, the film was still in production, and the studio in New York where I was doing my sound mix, I recorded some stuff with him. I guess he must have been there, and the guys running the studio let me know. And I decided to record some alternative. I needed some alternative audio, and I got him to voice. I think it was because a phone call I had with somebody talking about Betty was scratchy. Anyway, it didn't end up in the film, but Billy Campbell was very gracious. You know, the star of The Rocketeer was very gracious in just donating his time and doing a little thing for me to help out Betty Page Reveals All.
That's cool.
He's a super nice guy. We kind of lucked out. It's funny, Mark, we got a lot of parallels here using a lot of audio and like getting people to do VO work to make the doc work. But like, yeah, we were lucky to get him to do a little bit of participation. He moved to Norway at that point, so it was unlikely for us to be able to interview him in person. But the one guy that we were using his house for a set, the day with Brink Stevens and the helicopters and the gardeners, the guy who owned the house, our friend John Kroll, was a new Billy Campbell from having directed him and Bruce Campbell in a movie like years and years ago. And so while we were there shooting in his house, he like emailed Billy, I think in the morning we were interviewing Brink. And by the time Rebecca was being interviewed in the afternoon, he had an answer back saying, yeah, tell those guys to like contact me and I'll do what I can. And he ended up doing a little voiceover for us, doing a reading. And like it was like there was no studio or anything near where he lived. I think he just did it in his closet, right, from what I recall. You know what I mean? He just found his like little podcasting mic and he just said, I'll just go in the closet and try it. And he sent us a bunch of different deliveries, you know, and it was tough because it was without music, also very sad to hear him reading this. And then, but once we got the music in there, then that sort of helped balance that out. Because, you know, you don't want it to be too sad. You know what I mean? Obviously, Dave passed away very young, but like, we wanted the message of the movie to be sort of like, you know, the art lives on and like, other people will pick that baton up and go with it. You know, so.
Yeah.
Well, that's very funny. We both had Bill Campbell, star of The Rocketeer, do a little audio work for us in each of our films. That's funny.
Love that.
Where can people see your film?
It's available on most platforms, Amazon Prime, if you have a membership, iTunes for purchase. It's on YouTube on Samuel Goldwyn Films' YouTube channel for free, ad-driven. Tubi, Roku. It's on a couple of like library services. Canopy. Ooh, and what's the other one called? There's two library services that both have names that don't really, you know, kind of tell you what it is. Plex. It's on Plex. We're lucky with lots of having Samuel Goldwyn as a distributor. They sort of got it everywhere. It could go Google. I don't know. I'm running out of things to say now. Vudu. Yes, there's another one.
Well, that's good.
Kelvin, who made I was going to say, who made the cover poster for it? I really love the cover art.
Oh, thank you. That was a sort of like, that was Siobhan Christescu, our designer, who did a lot of cleanup on the Photoshop I mentioned earlier. But he was creative director on Disenchantment, the Netflix show created by Matt Groening. And he's worked for Matt on Simpsons and Futurama for like 20 some odd years. So he was just a good friend of mine. My wife used to work for Matt's comic book company. That's how I know him. And he's a great designer. And we just sort of like, we came up with the image that we thought was cool of David, the drawing board, sort of looking slyly over his shoulder. Like, okay, that's the image. How can we use this terrible, terrible old photo from Hanna-Barbera with all this junk around it and make it into something that sort of like, you know, reads as what you want it to be. So then, you know, the little pieces come along. Well, Betty's got to be in it. And the Rocketeer, and then just he's a brilliant designer. So he figured it out. He turned my like word soup into like something that was like, you know.
I love how it's like how Betty is like it's got Dave, it's got the Rocketeer, and it almost has like Betty as like the female lead, you know. And it kind of begs a question: could you even tell Dave Stevens' life story without including Betty in it? Like, how hard would that be?
I don't think that would have been possible. It's too integrated. Like, it's, and that's what there's so many things he did. If you look at the movie stuff and like storyboarding, like Thriller and Raiders of the Lost Ark, but like really it's Betty and the Rocketeer. If you're going to boil it down and not make it this just big montage. We actually had, this is kind of crazy. We actually had like actual double-sided one sheets that poster printed just for fun. We got like lucky. Somebody knew one of the big printers that did this work in town, and they had this like gap. We were told, oh, they have a little gap in work, so if we wanted to sneak in there and get this run of posters in, they could do it. And in fact, Ben, you're a fan, I can send you, we still have these posters, so like send me your info afterwards and I'll cool. send you out a, I mean, you can put it in a light box and stuff. It looks good, you know what I mean? So
I would, awesome. I would freak out. That would be so amazing.
Make Ben freak out.
I could send you a Betty Page Day poster. You know, we could trade.
Yeah, no, that would be awesome. That would be great.
Do you know the artist Mitch O'Connell?
Oh, of course, yeah, absolutely.
He did the official poster, or I say official, it wasn't official. He did the fan poster for Betty Page Day, and he draws Betty. You know, with Dave Stevens, there's so many artists draw Betty so well. You got Olivia, you've got Mitch O'Connell. Of course, Dave Stevens, you've got, you know, can get into the Eric Stanton stuff, but I love the way Mitch O'Connell draws her too. He really captures her essence. And so when he agreed to do the poster for Betty Page Day, I couldn't believe it. It was like a dream. Yeah. So I can send you one of those.
Oh yeah. I love it.
They're pretty awesome.
I think that would be, yeah, that would great. Be a lot of fun.
Hey, listen, we can have a poster marathon here. I Kelvin, I can send you the Betty Page Reveals All poster with the artwork by Olivia, which really looks, I don't know if you've seen the poster, but yeah. It looks
I great. Like, yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I she's great. I love her. She was very, she doesn't love being on camera, but no, she's very generous.
Yes. I was going to ask you, I mean, I don't want to embarrass Olivia, but I know what kind of experience you must've had in trying to interview her and then in trying to edit the interview.
Well, it just, you know, she made it clear that she was never going to watch it. So I was like, okay, it's fine. But we did go through a lot of, go through pains to make sure everyone looked as good as they could, this isn't a controversial documentary, you know, right. We're not trying to like, you know, get anybody. So, you know, we were just trying to figure out how to show them all in the best light. And I think the biggest problem was actually her, she's in that apartment in Malibu with Joel, and like just getting the equipment in. A lot of these studios for artists aren't that big. Scott Shaw was the worst. He's literally in a closet. This is how small it was. We had to put the lights in the backyard and shine them through the windows because they couldn't be in the room. Only me and like the DP could be in the room because I was behind the door. I was like sitting there still behind the door, and the camera and the tripod was blocking the door. So each time we had a mag change, the sound guy would crack the door, stick his hand in, we'd give him the thing, he'd pull it back, and then he'd come back with a clean one, and that's how we did it, you know. If there was sound problems in the room, like an airplane, I didn't know if it was bad because I couldn't see the sound guy, you know. He was in the hallway, you know. So there were some funny things with the filming. And then, you know, you go into Adam Hughes's studio and it's like the bowling alley and there's all this space, you know. And then we could do a real deep shot where there's a lot of depth. But like, not every artist has.
So were you shooting on film?
No. We were shot. It was a 8K.
Oh, when you
it was a red, but I can't remember.
When you
model.
Said mag change, I thought you were talking about a film magazine.
Oh no, we still say mag change when we mean memory card change.
Okay,
still,
all right.
I just finished shooting a documentary in Japan, and it's also all digital, but like we still say that. So,
right.
What else did we say? I mean, it's still, you know, it's still a slate, right?
Right. Even though, all the old film terms are still used.
Yeah. I love that stuff. One cool thing we had when we interviewed Joe Johnston, we were able to borrow a prop Rocketeer helmet, and also my friend Dave Mandel owned Joe had kept the slate. The clapperboard from the Rocketeer and sold it to my friend years ago. So he got to sort of hold it again, and it was like set deck for that day. And there was a cool helmet too, because it had like a bullet ricochet in it. So you kind of figure out when it is in the movie. Cause it's gotta be after that scene. It's like a ricochet, and its fin has a little nick out of it, you know, continuing where the bullet went. That was cool just to have him holding this stuff again and sort of reminiscing about it. And that didn't make the movie, but like, that was just kind of cool to hang out with some of these people. And I was lucky to have known a number of them from before. So, where was I going with this? I don't know. Back to you, Mark.
Well, you guys have anything else to ask Kelvin?
I just think it's really, the film just really cemented for me how equally pivotal Dave and Betty were ultimately in each other's life stories. That's so poetic, and for them to have been such best friends to each other and truly just have this, you know, they're forever intertwined.
No,
you know, kind of like the Rocketeer image of, you know, the Rocketeer with Betty.
Yes. Yes. No, exactly. You know, only perhaps not with her gagged and thrown over his shoulder.
Maybe some small differences, you know.
Progressive, right? The progressive
exactly.
Grandmother that Mark was hanging out with, talking about bondage.
Yep.
I just love how protective Dave was of Betty. You know, I'm a comic book guy. I go to comic book stores. I did in the 90s. So I saw some of the stuff that started coming out in the late 80s, early 90s, the Betty Page, like bootleg kind of stuff. Like, well, I mean, I guess there was no official stuff back then, but you know what I mean? It's kind of a little more seedy, kind of just not that, kind of like B market kind of stuff. And I like how Dave distanced himself from that and decided that he was going to help her financially, while there was all these other just weird things coming out, like the, you know, those card sets that came out,
right,
and
right,
stuff.
Right.
And
he had his own problems with people bootlegging his stuff, so I think he kind of understood that. But he also felt like he owed a big debt to her. So, I mean, he really held her up on a pedestal, and he did try and help her get compensated wherever he could. I know he did go to other artists and stuff and tell them, hey, you really have to be paying her. And unfortunately, I mean, this is one of those tragic things, like, you know, until most artists they're not the best business people. So, you know, obviously her estate makes millions every year now. Right. And Dave, we were working on the reprinting the Rocketeer comics. There was a point where it was doing so well that we sort of looked at the numbers and said, you know, I think it's made more money now than he made in his lifetime with it, which is a tragedy. I it was one of those really sort of sad, ironic things where you're like, oh, we're trying to do a good job, and we did a good job, but now it's kind of sad, you know, thinking about that. And it's the same thing with Betty. One of the things that was kind of sad also is we were pretty sure she didn't know he'd passed away, because he was very adamant to his friends not to tell her, not to, you know, upset her. So he knew that she knew that he wasn't around much, but I don't know to what degree she even knew he was sick. So, and to me, that's the ultimate sort of thing where you're trying to protect somebody else.
Yeah.
That, you know, you put their mental well-being ahead of your own.
Right. So. Well, and Betty was pretty ill in the last year of her life, and I guess they both passed away in the same year.
Yes, that's right. About 6 months apart, I think. He was March and she was December, if I remember correctly. Mm. So, yeah, that also a sort of sad irony. But, you know, I mean, you know, like Betty Page's firmly ingrained in, you know, in certainly in American society and the aesthetic, you know what I mean? Like, you know, you see people wearing her style, you know, like emulating that everywhere, you know, that's going to be around, you know, forever, you know? So,
yeah.
So that, to me, that's a great way, you know, that's the way people sort of gain a kind of immortality. Yeah. So, you know, through art. Yeah. You know, so we do have lofty goals sometimes, right, Mark?
Of course, yes. That's why we're artists, right? So, so before we sign off, I need to plug one of my films that's just coming out. Actually, it's been re-released. My very first film, Building Bombs, which was released in 1989, received an Academy Award nomination in 1991. It's about a nuclear weapons factory in South Carolina, a whistleblower exposing all the dumping of radioactive waste there. So that film just got a 4K restoration by the Motion Picture Academy and is now being re-released. Awesome. And it's in something called the International Uranium Film Festival. It's touring the U.S. It'll be screening in Asheville, North Carolina at the UNC Asheville on March 23rd at the Music Box Theater in Chicago on March 31st. And it's going to be in Spokane, Washington, April 3rd or 4th. And one or both of us, the filmmakers, will be at all of those. And then we're going to Rio de Janeiro, where the International Uranium Film Festival is giving us the award, a special jury award for restoration of an historic work. So I just...
That's so cool.
Oh, fantastic. Congratulations.
Yeah.
So, and just people just, you know, Google it and find out where else the film is going to be playing if you want to watch it. And of course... The unrestored version is still available online. So,
and what do you know yet? If there'll be, will there be a Atlanta screening?
Oh, we're definitely going to do it. You know, because everybody that worked on that film is from Atlanta. We're definitely going to do an Atlanta screening. I don't know when yet.
All right.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you, Calvin. So much fun finding out about your film and Dave Stevens and everything you did. And
yeah, it was awesome for me just to learn more about Dave as a person. So thank you.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me on and helping me to keep keep his work alive and his and Betty's work alive. Mark, I'm curious, is there will there be a 4K version or is there a 4K version of your Betty Page doc? Is that something that might be in the cards?
Well, that's a good question. I actually hadn't thought about that. But, you know, with all those great photographs of Betty, seeing those in 4K would be amazing, right? So thank you for planting that idea.
Yes.
Well, I'll be the first one to buy one. So, you know, it's very selfish of me. You know.
Of course.
And Kelvin, as a fan, it was really, really cool meeting you virtually. And I was wondering, what's next for you? Do you have any projects in the pipes going on?
It was great meeting you too, Ben. I mean, hopefully we can run into each other at a show someplace. You know what I mean? You bundled up in Seattle with your while I'm drinking whiskey off to the side. You know, I'll keep warm that way. You can keep warm with the outfit. I just got back from Japan, as I said before. My next documentary is about Japanese whiskey. Which is something we're passionate about. You know, the whiskey thing, as you see it all, kind of comes full circle. And it's something that I've been interested in for about 10 years. And, you know, whiskey drinkers who are collectors kind of do it differently than people who are just, you know, going for volume, shall we say. So it's very much a collector's mentality where we're very into the minutiae and the history and all this stuff. So I'm trying to do something that sort of like tells the history and, it's very popular in the world right now, both to drink and as investment. So it would be cool to basically to explain, you know, how do we get to this point?
Is Suntory part of that?
Suntory is a big part of that industry. They had their 100th anniversary last year. So last year was the 100th anniversary of whiskey in Japan. Whiskey they make it in Scotland in Japan. So Suntory time and Nika is there. Suntory and Nika, sort of the Coke and Pepsi of that industry. So.
Okay, well, it sounds great.
We'll look forward to seeing that. That sounds really interesting. Yeah.
Thank you. It also has perfection in the name. That was the one thing we couldn't get away with. The movie's tentatively called Distilled to Perfection. The Spirit of Japanese.
Oh, I love that. That's cool.
So the problem with that, of course, is you must come up with a third one now. So that
exactly. Yeah.
All your looks like you did this on purpose, you know.
All your films are going to have the word perfection in them.
I know. I'm going to figure out. I don't know what the next one's going to be. If you guys have any ideas, I'm open to suggestions.
Okay. Sounds good.
We'll keep you posted on that.
All right.
Well, thank you again for coming on, especially with the certain jet lag from your Japan trip.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, I'm okay really right now.
But good.
Any minute now, you know.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
We really appreciate you making the time.
All right.